Kane, Stephen, Molly, and everybody on Zoom, wherever you may be. We're all in for a treat, and welcome, and Dave, you're most welcome to begin.
Thank you, Paige. Appreciate it very much. Sorry I can't be there. But the first thing that I'd say about your group is a lot of people are probably saying, you're going to any length to get it if you invite me for 20 years. But it's good to be invited anywhere this damn town and be a part and share in the program. I'm an alcoholic. And my name is Dave Cook. Hi, everybody.
Hey, Dave.
By God's grace and because this program works for me, through the help of some understanding sponsors that handled me with a very calm but firm hand, and through the love of two women in my life, my former wife and my present wife, Judith, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since I became alcoholic now. My sobriety date is September the 12th, 1957, and I'm very grateful for this sobriety. You know, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in Roanoke, Virginia, it was stressed that you give your sobriety date. And that's the reason I did, because that's where I learned to give my sobriety date. It was in the early years in the old Central Group in Roanoke, Virginia. I can honestly say that as what I've been going through in the past few weeks, two and a half months, it's something I never experienced before, and I'm looking forward to going back to a real AA meeting, as I call an AA meeting, where we sit down and share our heart. And I know a lot of you are doing the same thing. But I've also learned something else through this virus that I've come to understand a lot about me that I didn't know. I have a reputation of being very impatient, and let me tell you, I've been very impatient in this ordeal, let me tell you. But I'm working on it, and hope it gets better. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You might say that I was homeless, because I wound up in the streets in Roanoke, Virginia. I was a fellow that had a some success after college, graduating from college and coaching high school basketball. I came from a loving home. My mother was a wonderful woman. My father was a fine man as long as he didn't drink. And as a matter of fact, as I understand it, because of the drinking, lived through a divorce in my home when I was 12 years of age. And my mother was able to financially to raise us three children, my two sisters and myself, and give us all education and start life. And I thank God for that. And I remember my father, he always said the same old thing, he was a good man as long as he didn't drink. And he never abused the family or anything like that. He was just one of these heavy drinkers that stay away from home. And I remember promising mother as a kid that I'd never be like him. I'd never be like him. And as the truth was known, as later on found out that although he lost a family, he didn't get kicked out of the profession he was in. He didn't have to serve time. And then you have to walk on the streets like I did later on. And I look back now, and when I was in college, it's where the drinking started. Fellows from World War II had just come back, and they were older than I was, and I was exposed to this group. And of course, as the old saying, you know, if you stay in an environment long enough, you'll become a part of that environment. And that's what happened to me. I became part of the environment. I want to do what the big boys do. And drinking to me in the early years in college, I didn't get me into trouble. I didn't know what a hangover was. I had a good time drinking and good fun. And then when I graduated, I was offered, I studied engineering, but I was offered a job coaching high school basketball down in Eastern North Carolina. And I decided to do this as a career, really and truly. And I don't know, I look back now, I think my ego got in the way, and that's where it all started. I was very successful for 2 years at one location, and then very successful at another school for 6 years. And in the school for 6 years is where my drinking really multiplied and began to get in trouble. Now, I had been meeting some of my classmates on weekends. We'd have these weekend affairs. We'd all get drunk, go home, get sober, and start again. It went on and continued until at this particular school, I got to the point that I was drinking about every morning before class. And it got to be a necessity. And it got to be trouble as a result of it. And I remember the school officials calling me in the first time, the principal primarily, talking to me about my drinking. And of course, I denied it. And you know, to keep talking to you, begin to realize you got to do something. And that's what happened to me. I wanted to get people off the back, divert their attention. And I did. I found a lady that I briefly known, and in a short courtship, we got married. And it was a relationship and a marriage that didn't work out at all. And I was involved in this marriage for about 2 years. Nothing but trouble the whole time, denying everything I was doing and lying about everything. And finally, the school officials got to the point that they gave me the opportunity to resign on account of my drinking. Now, I had got to, like I said, I was coaching high school basketball. I was going to ball games sometime about half booed up, not drunk, just feeling good, you know, loose, and drinking vodka. And I look back now, and I was a sick person as I know it today. And I can remember the trouble I got into was a girl's basketball team. The fellow that was coaching girls had to go in to service and asked me to take over the girls' team in the middle of the year, which I did. And I'd been in the habit of hitting the boys on the rear when they started the game, and I'll start doing that with the girls. And some parents got upset. I didn't understand why in the beginning, but I did the next morning when the school board met. And it was later on part of the reason I left that school. And as a matter of fact, I left that and went a little bit further east. A little bit further east, and I've always said that if you go far enough down east in this state, you wind up at the end of it, and that's what happened to me. And this school I went to was hired me with the condition that they didn't think I was drinking like I was at one time. And I lasted this school for 6 months. And it got to the point that the marriage had fallen apart. I was living in Rocky Mount. Living in Rocky Mount, driving back and forth about to Leggett, to the northeast, well, you know where it is now. And driving back and forth, and we'd usually have some hit in the gym, or I could get a hold of some in that. About 12, I knew what would happen, the shake would start. And I either had some in the gym or the automobile. Drink enough to stop the shake, to pray for 3 o'clock, to start back to Rocky Mount, to do the same thing again. And this lasted for a period of about 6 months. And finally got to the point that one day at school, in the morning, the principal called me to the side and said, "Son, we don't need you anymore. You can leave anytime you want to. Just give us the keys." There was no discussion. There was no office meeting to discuss this thing. And as I look back now at this event in my life, I really believe that that's when I came to believe that I really crossed that invisible line that we speak of. I'd become an alcoholic, although I didn't know it. Because I'd gotten to the point I'd do anything but drink liquor. And that day I left school and don't know where I went for 2 weeks until I wound up in jail for the first time. In jail right in the city of Rocky Mountain. A man came to me through a cell door one morning. I've been gone for about 2 weeks. And this man says, your mother has come down here and straightened out all this mess. And we're going to send you to a place where they can cure you. And to me, I didn't know exactly what he meant, but I later found out where the cure was going to be. And my mother made arrangements to send me to Dixie Hill, to state insane asylum, to the alcoholic ward, and I was admitted there. But the first time, when I was about 27 years old, maybe close to 28, and I never want to forget my first trip to Dixie Hill. I got there that day, and the county sheriff carried me to Raleigh to put me in this place. Nobody around me was the same age I was, and I remember they sprayed me down and gave me a outfit to wear. And then I was allowed to do the only thing I could do, walk up and down the hall wondering what I was doing there until I began to have some problems. And the problems were DTs, hallucinations, a lot of bad things, until it finally put me in a cell they called it down in the basement. And in this cell, they'd take your clothes away from you and let you have your running fits. That was the cure for alcoholism in 1956-57. And that's what I experienced. I was in there long enough that they finally let me out and put me upstairs with the rest of the people, and they had a problem with the booze. The men were a lot older than I. A lot older than I. And I look around, there was nobody my age. And of course, you know, you begin to wonder, what are you doing there? And I thought somebody made a terrible mistake. And I began to take the intellectual route. I was there to write a book or something of that nature. But one night, some men were playing poker. They were discussing the reason they are. One man spoke up and says, I'm here because I'm an alcoholic. And I heard it for the first time in my life, wondering, really, paralleling to my father who had a drinking problem, and thinking that that's what an alcoholic was. And I was sicker than anybody else probably in that institution that time. I stayed at Dixie Hill for 30 some days until they asked me to, I was allowed to leave. And the only place I had to go was back to my hometown, Mullock Rapids. And my mother had, with the cause of me going to this place, but she took me in when I got home and began to try to help me. And nothing worked out because I went back to drinking. And to make a long story short, I went back to Dixville 5 times in 6 months. On account of one fact, as I know it today, that I've become an alcoholic. I take one drink and I can no longer guarantee you my behavior. And that's the condition I got in. The last time I went back to Dixville, they didn't put me in the alcoholic unit, they put me in the nut ward with the rest of them. And I look back and I begin to set my faith that I was one of them, and that's what really happened. But God, I think, was working in my life way back then, and although I didn't know it, by some mysterious reasoning, by coincidence, I guess, I was moved back to the alcoholic ward. And you got to understand that I've been there so much that I had become working in the kitchen, waiting on tables and doing the hall jobs. And I was allowed to go to the main building to pick up the mail every morning and had two assistants to go with me to help. And we were doing this every morning. And this particular morning, we had a staff meeting and we decided we would escape. Back then was like cops and robbers over at Dixie Hill. And that's what we did that afternoon. And we were able to get downtown Raleigh that afternoon. One of them had some money. We got a hold of a jug and a hotel, the old Andrew Johnson Hotel. Been torn down for years. And we were there enjoying ourselves, loosening up, and the 6 o'clock news came on, and you know what I'm talking about when the flashes come on about something really happened that causes everybody to get stirred up, and what came across at the bottom of the screen, the three criminal insane that just escaped from Dix Hill. And of course, you know, one of the fellows would wonder who the hell it is. And of course, the other fellow began to cry. And as a matter of fact, I've always said he left. And I don't know all of what happened to him, but he left and never came back. And the other fellow and I decided we'd better split up since we're a gang mate. And that's what we did. And the next morning on the streets in Raleigh, a friend of my mother knew me and knew my background and the trouble I'd been in and where I was, and put me on a bus and sent me back to my hometown in Roanoke Rapids. Unbeknownst to me, I got to my mother's home on the right side of town and all that, and broke into the house and didn't know she was in Richmond with a nervous breakdown. And that's where I was for about a week until they bummed off a friend of the family. And when they brought her home, they found me. I don't know if you know who they are or not, but they at that time were my two sisters and my mother, and my friend of the family was like a father to me. And they got together, and the end result was they'd come to the conclusion that I needed to leave that part of the country I was killing more. And they gave me a lot of money to tell me to leave, and I knew the minute. And I began to see the green on my hip, and I could understand. I thought it was a good idea, too. And of course, I didn't go far. I could have gone a long way to the West Coast if I wanted to, but I didn't. I went 4 miles to the neighboring town over to Weldon and pulled in the old Weldon Hotel and drank, spent money until the money gave out. Had a lot of friends there for a while. And when the money gave out, I had to do something, and I've done what I've done many times before. I went over to my hometown and wrote a big check at a friend's business to buy an outboard motor. I didn't have a boat, but I bought a motor. And write a big check, get some change, pick up the motor later. Now, a few days later, the next day, as a matter of fact, this friend of the family called my mother to let her know my motor was ready. And the end result was my mother kind of knew what had happened. And the next that afternoon, John Law from Roanoke Rapids in that hotel and carried me back to my hometown, put me in jail. And I was in hometown Roanoke Rapids at the jail, 3 blocks from my mother's home, and nobody would have anything to do with me. Nobody came to see me. I was raising a lot of hell once in a while down there being locked up. It looked like everybody left the next day except me. And you got to understand something. I said I wanted to talk to my attorney one night. I finally got to jail, and he says, "Who is your attorney?" And I told him. He said, "Talk to him all you want to. He's in that cell block." And sure enough, he was. And this is a man that later on, after I got sober, and tried to come back to North Carolina. He's the man that helped me come back to North Carolina. He found Alcoholics Anonymous later, became a member of our state legislature, and was very successful law practice. And he's the man that helped me when I came back to North Carolina in 59. But as I said, I had to stand trial with somebody I didn't know on a previous drunk and a blackout. There in the town, and then I had to go down to the county seat for another trial, and the end result was a few weeks later I was on a chain gang down in East North Carolina down in Great Dismal Swamp. This is what happened to me. This is what happened to me as a result of booze. And at no time at that time did I think I had a problem. I really didn't. remember something. When I got to this prison camp, a man began to talk to me, he was a superintendent of the place, talk to me about maybe I need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd heard about AA and Dixie Hill, and I was one of the guys that got in the back of the room and kind of cut up when they were trying to have a meeting. And little did I know that I was going to have to look for Alcoholics Anonymous at a later age, but that's what happened. And in this moment in my drinking, it got to the point that nobody could tell me much, but as a result of the trials, like I said, I was finally put on the chain gang and served long enough to get back home, and my mother let me back in after a period of being locked up and good behavior. And I look back now and the people that tried to help me all this time. Like I said at Dix Hill, I should have listened, but I didn't. Like I said later, when I went to some drying out places for help that my mother sent me to, I enjoyed tapering off it, but I'd go back to drinking. And sometimes I might take a look at myself at what was causing all this. And then as I look back now, I really know that the fact was that I began to get my health back, the liar in order to revive again, I become that same person that always been. And I couldn't deal with reality. I just couldn't deal with reality. When I got back from the chain gang, my mother really, I didn't know what she'd have anything to do with me or not, but she did. And she let me in and tried to help me and guide me. And I stayed sober for a period of time. Not sober, I've just been drinking. And for a period of time, until it was suggested maybe I should go to work. Didn't think I could get a job in the state of North Carolina because of what had happened. And through an agency up in Richmond, Virginia, I was interviewed in the state of Maryland, in the state of Virginia, in a period of 1 week. And my mother carried me to these places for these interviews to teach school and coach basketball if I could. And on a particular Thursday afternoon, I guess it was, in Roanoke, Virginia, a man interviewed me. He was the superintendent of city schools in Roanoke, the largest high school in that district, Jefferson Senior High School. I was offered a job after being interviewed. And he asked me in the interview that I understood after a telephone call that I'd had a problem drinking at one time, and I agreed that I did, but I was doing fine then. And he gave me a chance for a new start to life. Now, this is a man that I've been through what I have been through. A new start in life completely. I went back to my hometown that day, and my mother financed the whole expedition for me to go back to Roanoke to file in the ceremony, to take a job, to go to work, and a place to stay, clothes, a bank account, and everything. And on the way back, I had to have a little change buses in Richmond, had a layover, but I got one bottle. Well, I bought, two bottles, two pints, to just get me on the way. And this was the beginning of my last drunk, the only drunk that I really like to talk about. Because this is the drunk that got me to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1957. I got back to Roanoke. I didn't check into the place. I had a place to stay. I checked into the hotel on the hill and began living it up. Got drunk, drinking. I was able to work 5 days at school until I got to the weekend when I couldn't go back to school the following Monday. And the school officials intervened and found out what they had and tried to help me. And they tried to help me. And my mother got in touch with me. I was in the old hotel in Roanoke. And my mother had talked to the manager, and it seemed as though she didn't want to help me. But she gave me the greatest gift that's ever given me since I was born. That's when she kicked me out of her life that day, and I knew she meant it. Told me to never come home again, that I was not a member of the family. And that afternoon, I was kicked out of the hotel and wound up on the streets of Northern Virginia. The only man that knew me in that city on the following Sunday became concerned about me, and he talked to my mother, he talked to the hotel, but he just wanted to help a drunk. He didn't know I was a drunk. He didn't know anything about alcoholics or not, but he wanted to help a human being. And that man found me that Sunday morning in a back alley in downtown Roanoke. And I don't know about you, but I've gotten to the point that morning that a drink didn't do me any good. I come to the point that I knew that I was dying from what I was doing, and I didn't want to die in that back alley. And that man found me that morning and carried me to his home over in Southwest Roanoke, got in touch with a man that knew a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and got the officials, the school officials, the superintendent, the principal, to carry me to what was known then as the Easy Does It Club in downtown Roanoke, a clubhouse for alcoholics. And that's where I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time that Sunday. You looked me over when I got down. I was nervous, I was shaky, I didn't have good vision, and I just got tired of being tired. I got tired of the high cost of low living. And I met some people that I remember in the early, just the first few moments, the members started talking to the people that brought me in. There was an old gentleman to the right. His name was Old Man John. And Old Man John walked over to me as I was listening, and he put his arm around my shoulder. And I never forgot what that man told me. And I'll tell it to anybody else. He said, "Son," says, "all you got to do is listen to these people and do what they tell you to do, and you don't have to be alone anymore." And that old man rang my bell. That was the first few lines of chapter 5. You know, rarely have we seen a person fail who has told the Father our path. That's what he was telling me, although I didn't know it. And later they began to talk to me, some of the members. And then I said something about a drink, and they said, "We don't do it that way." And then I said something about taking a pill or a tablet, and said, "No." I thought I'd start a revolution then. I said, "Drink the coffee." And that was the day I started drinking AA coffee and got sick from it. I really did. And I thought it was a requirement I had to drink that AA coffee. And it was the kind of coffee that I've always said that you know when you drink it, because It was strong stuff, and I'll never forget it. And I've always said that a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous making coffee that don't have any business doing it. And my God, that was one of those days. It was that bad, it was. And I was carried to my first meeting that night, and I didn't know anything about what was going on. It was upstairs, the old Central Group. And the meeting, some guy talked, I don't know what it said, but I just wanted to leave, didn't know what was going on. And strangers, complete strangers, walk up to me and said, "Dave, we love you and we understand you're going to be all right." That's all I was told when I walked in the doors of AA. "We love you, we understand, and you're going to be all right." And that night, it was true to me I didn't have to be alone anymore. Three men got me a room at the YMCA in Roanoke, Virginia, and sat down and stayed with me all night long, talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous and their story. And as I began to look back back, and I really believe that that's when I came to believe that maybe I could do it after listening to them. Maybe I could do it. And I realized now that in the dark recess of my mind, I knew one fact. I had to be around them to do it in order to do what they were talking about. And that was my beginning that night in the journey of Alcoholics Anonymous the next morning, when a man met me for the first time and became my sponsor, although I didn't ask for him, and led me in the road to recovery that I know today. and gave me basic alcoholics anonymous of no debate from the big book of AA, the 12 step and the 12 addiction. I was fortunate enough to be in a group that was really interested in the program of alcoholics helping others. And this was the beginning of my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's been a good journey for many years because that was the beginning. September 12, 1958. And I never want to forget how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and where I was and what's happened to me and where I am today. And when I began to feel sorry for myself like I have in the past few weeks, once in a while with this virus, I have to ask myself a question. Where were you? Where were you then and where are you now? And who gets credit for it? And the God of my understanding found me the program of Alcoholics Anonymous within me. And I got active in AA in Raleigh, in Roanoke, and then I met my former wife, Sue, there, and we were later married when we moved to Raleigh. I moved to Raleigh in June of 59, and attended my first state convention in May of 59, and went to Salem, and Alonzo brought me down to meet people from Raleigh, and I'd already met my second sponsor before I got there because he made arrangements for a man to sponsor when I got to Raleigh named Tom Burrell. And Tom was a very influence in my life after I got to Raleigh. And I've joined the old Hayes Ward group back in June of 59 and was a member of that group for 5 years until we started the Big Book group. But I've been around for a while and I thank God for the fact that I've been around people that, sponsors that led me, as I said in the beginning, with a kind and firm hand. And a lot of it, I was sponsored like I needed help, and I got help. And I'm on my self-sponsor right now. And the previous ones, they passed on, but each one of them gave me something. And I look back, the sponsor I have now has a assisted living place and kind of crippled at what he can do, but I still have contact with him, at least on a weekly or bi-weekly basis. Now, as a result of what's been going on in the past few weeks, I mentioned on a Zoom program the other night that I'd spent a lot of time with myself. And it forced me to get to a point where I had to take another fourth step in my sobriety. Here's a man with 62.5 years taking a fourth step, reviewing his life and what's going on. And I know that I received so much from Alcoholics Anonymous that now I'm at the point that I just feel like it's something I have to give back. And I want to be in the position to help someone else as long as I can. And that's the reason you will find me at AA meetings. Even at the age I am and all the amount of sobriety I have, because I depend upon Alcoholics Anonymous. The greatest thing to me has ever been is Alcoholics Anonymous. The longer I'll stay sober, the greater it becomes. I have to go to meetings of AA. That's where it is. I have to try to work the 12 steps because that's what it's all about. And I try to help others. And I happen to know that yesterday is my experience and today is my hope. Tomorrow is my hope. And today I'm going one of the best I can, doing one of the best I can. And I know as long as I do this, I too can walk hand in hand with you down this happy road of destiny that we speak of in Alcoholics Anonymous by doing this program one day at a time, one day at a time. Because it's proven to me that God will help me if all I've got to do is ask Him for help. I want to close by saying this, and the group, your group in Rocky Mount, has been very kind to invite me down there over the years, and it's hard for me to believe it's been that many. But I appreciate it, and like I say, I thank the page for going to any length to get me to come down there. and I appreciate it very much. But I'd like to close with a statement that I make every time I make a talk, because it says my story and probably yours. And it's from the big book. And for a long time, I didn't tell people where it came from until I had to get honest. And it's in the book. And it goes something like this. This great experience that released me from the bondage of hatred, released me with love, is just an affirmation of truth I know. I get everything I need in Alcoholics Anonymous, and everything I need I get. And when I get what I need, I invariably find that it was just what I want all the time. Thank you for listening, and I appreciate the opportunity to share with you. And sorry I couldn't be down that night, but we did the right thing by not driving down there.